All right, hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Canuck Crosscast. We are going to spend some time talking about the Karst period, talking about the upcoming World Championships and the people who are not attending, as well as people who are attending, and in general, just talk about cross. And to do that, we have special guest, the owner, operator, video editor, maestro-in-chief, big media himself, Bill Shiken. And he's going to share his thoughts, and we'll sort of follow a script of some sort today, maybe. We'll see. Anyways, welcome, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. How are you all doing?
Not too bad. Yeah, it's I'm back in Canada now. I got in on Thursday. Yeah, Thursday night, and I came back to a blizzard, basically. It's so snowy. We don't usually get snow here, and it's like a couple feet everywhere. Do you have that in Kamloops too, Jen, or more?
We got quite a bit of snow. It's like, I think the difference is, like, you get snow in Chilliwack, and it just makes it gross, but we get snow here, and it becomes, like, perfect winter utopia, where we can ski, and it's just super nice, so. But welcome back. I saw you got out for a ride, though, so it's gotta be not too bad. I saw Ricky's out at the cabin, but maybe in town it's clear.
Yeah, it's like, if I look out at my street right now, it looks like winter wonderland. If you go out actually into the prairie, it's like the roads are dry and there's just snow in the fields, and it's not too bad. I was like this far away from riding Zwift, and then I realized that I actually really am miserable the entire time I'm riding a trainer, and I shouldn't do that to myself, so I went outside instead.
You'll only be miserable for the parts of the ride where you're cold. And then there's like that nice middle part where you're okay. You're not like the starting cold, and then you're not the I've been out here for 3 hours cold.
Yeah, I mean, I saw you were like a 4 hour Zwift master these days.
I did one.
That's insane.
Thank you.
I don't love cycling that much. Congratulations.
Well, it's different when you're building back the fitness. Well, Bill probably knows. Yeah. Just the efficiency of it. I see Bill on the Zwift here and there.
Rarely, but hey, guess what? I have snow too, in the mid-Atlantic of the U.S. Yeah, I came back from Belgium, and I was like, "What the heck's going on here?"
How often do you guys get snow in Washington?
It could be like once or twice a year, maybe, and some years not at all.
Okay,
we'll have stretches that are in the, you know, that are below freezing for a couple weeks, but normally, yeah. Snow's a rarity here. So of course the place was, I missed all the chaos. Just got back to the snow.
I was
on the ground.
I can't remember if someone on Twitter was saying that, you know, the conditions in DuPage where like you guys had cross nationals, it's like super, super cold and like absolutely snow covered right now, because this past weekend was cross nationals weekend. So people were kind of like counting their blessings about that. But on that note, Michael, I'd like to congratulate you on your 2022 national championship.
Why, thank
continuation.
Yeah. I was going to ask about that because the last I needed to catch up with both of you. So, Michael, yeah. So no nationals. So I know it was postponed, right? And then they just went ahead and canceled it because of the world.
Everything.
Yeah, that's right. So it was supposed to be on the 7th on national championship weekend, which would have been kind of fun outside of the fact that, you know, it's also snowy where nationals were going to happen. And the date kind of came and went, and I almost forgot about it. Like, how many Instagram posts have I done now where I was like, this is the day nationals were supposed to be? Well, it's two of them, and I didn't feel like doing a third one, and I kind of forgot it was supposed to happen. Like, I guess the third time something canceled, it starts losing its significance or something like that. But yeah, national champion for life at this rate. I don't think I'll ever have to win again. I'm going to be like 80 in the jersey.
Don't have to buy those new kits either, so it's good. You should be good to go.
That's right. The only thing that we're trying to, I have no part in sorting this out, is Cycling Canada is trying to figure out the UCI points side of things, because as it stands right now, basically every other country has had a national championships. And Canada has
it's
not.
Like 100.
And it's 100 points for the winner. So it impacts me a little bit.
I would still have like 60 or 80 points from the last time
ago.
I raced cross.
And
are you nervous that you won't make the world's team?
Me? Or Michael?
Oh, I've been selected for the worst team. I'll be okay.
Oh, congratulations. Congratulations.
Yeah. But yeah, like as it stands, it's 100 points. And honestly, I can see the argument for including them and excluding them. Like the argument for excluding them is pretty simple. It's, well, the race didn't happen and those points are like 2 years old at this point in time. So how relevant are they? But the argument for including them is, realistically, the same people that won Nationals 2 years ago were going to win them this year, barring something going wrong. You know, that's Magali and myself. And like, don't count your eggs before they hatch type thing. But we've both shown that we're kind of at that level still. And for me, it impacts me a little bit. For Magali, it will, if she doesn't get those points, it'll likely take her to the front row for Fayetteville, which, yes, you can win races from the second row. You can get on the podium from the second row. We've seen it time and time again, but it's not making your life any easier. And I guess there's also the question of, what is fair in this situation? Is it fair to give Magali and myself points for a race that didn't happen? Maybe not, but is it fair to not have the chance to earn those points at all? Maybe not
as
well.
I think it comes to the point where the UCI just looks at us and says, you didn't have the race. Like 2 years in a row. This year, I'd say it was canceled more because of the flooding than because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a bummer. We kind of went through that with mountain bike too, but
you guys had a race though.
We did this year, but we didn't in 2020.
They already don't like North America scofflaws because we, you know, don't race on their Nationals Day, so we're already illegitimate nationals as it goes in North America, and I guess Australia too.
I suspect that you're both right. I have a hard time seeing the UCI agreeing to give Canadians points for a race that didn't happen, right? Like,
well, like, what do they do for these younger kids? Like, we're going to kind of just maybe segue into like how well some of our young kids are racing. Like, we have juniors now who are first year juniors who raced as cadets, which isn't a UCI category. So like, you know, you can't just think about the elites. Like, yeah, we get our rankings changed a little bit, but what about these kids who literally weren't in that category? But they would be benefiting enormously. Like, you talk about, you know, a 16, 17 year old starting, you know, the difference 100 points makes when they go to Worlds is huge.
Oh, absolutely. And we have some podium potential people in the junior categories, both men's and women's. I think that's actually a good segue into one of the things we did want to talk about is, the Holmgrens, Ava and Isabella Holmgren, were both absolutely crushing it over in Europe. Ian Ackert got on the podium, had some great races in Europe, and so did Luke Valenti. He was fifth at Ball. It's just really cool to see. I don't think I've ever seen this many Canadian juniors. I don't think I've ever seen this many Canadians like in the top 10 on podiums in Europe during Kerst period. It's not something that we've had before. Like, I know there's a bit of a track record of American juniors making that jump, but not so much the case for us. You know, maybe we've had someone on the podium once or twice before, but this is like a whole new... The new kids are fast, you know, and they're coming up, and it's just really cool to see as someone coming from the generation where it seemed like we were...
Everyone was a latecomer to cross. Like, these are kids who are racing cross through Rob's program from, you know, the time they were like... I feel like these kids have been waiting to race internationally since before I started racing, like 5 years ago. Like, these kids have literally been racing, ready, waiting for this moment, and they're like... Now they have their moment, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I remember Ian Ackert, one of the fast juniors now. Like, I stayed at his place at Pan Ams in 2017, which isn't actually that long ago, but when you're 17, it is. And he was, like, spending every single hour of the day riding his bike around, like, hopping on the back wheel, you know, doing cross skills. He would do his race and spend, like, 8 hours for the rest of the day when the rest of the races were having, like, riding around the course and ripping ruts and stuff. And... Yeah, for you and I, we don't have that. I started racing cross when I was 20. You started riding bikes when you were like, what, 22, 23? It's like the new wave. So I guess, Bill, the question for you here is, you guys have seen that in the US and there's been some people pop up on the international stage, but like, how do we make sure as a country, or what needs to happen to make sure that these kids in 5-10 years are still there? It's one thing to have junior success. It's like another thing to have that translate into elite success. And I feel like every year you look down the junior world championships at cross and there's like Czech riders, there's Hungarian riders, there's like, of course, there's Belgians and Dutch riders. There's all these other countries that are represented. And then you go and you look at the elite races and it's still like 8 Belgians or 8 Dutch riders going 1 through 8.
That's kind of the question for the ages. You know, how do we make this success carry over into the elite levels? And I don't think that any North Americans really, on the men's side exclusively, have cracked that code in a long time. But before I even get to that, let me ask you this about the junior success, especially in Belgium. Do you think nationals getting canceled and then the decision, I'm assuming it seemed like there were a lot more people than at Pan Ams at the junior level, U23 level, that maybe were planning on going before nationals was canceled. It seemed like there was a concerted effort from Canada to say, hey, let's just send everybody there. Do you think that going away from home, having that experience, having success was a good, almost like a little training camp before going to Europe, to sort of like, okay, this is what it's like being away from home as a group, as a team, racing, and now we're going to go and try to replicate that in some of these races?
Yeah, I mean, that's like, that we did send, like, Cycling Canada did organize a project to go down to Pan Ams this year, which was a piece of feedback that we gave, I think, like, even in 2019, about like, what can we do to get one more kids racing bigger events and give them the experience? And we're like, well, Pan Ams is a big deal. Why don't we, you know, we benefited from having Pan Ams in Midland in Canada for 2 years. So we had, you know, good representation, but just giving some organization to go to these races in the US, because honestly, it's not, you know, maybe it is easier for some because their parents can just drive them down to the States, but going to the States for these like series of races, like, and the, you know, Pan Ams included, but like all the World Cups, like, it's not like a ton easier than going to Europe. It's still just, it's kind of just as far and just as expensive. The advantage is that you speak English. So we're like, we need to give some support and some structure.
I mean, dollar for the race, it's usually much cheaper to go to Europe. And I don't know if, like, especially for Canadians, I think that's why you often see Canadians choosing to go to Europe for mountain biking as well, over top of spending a ton of time in the States. Because, and you know, an international flight to Europe is $1,000 to $1,500, and you just get to stay in one spot versus spending like $500 to $700 every single time you go down to the US. At a certain point, it just makes sense. Like, I've thought about this lots over the years, is I could probably spend less money on my season if I just camped out in Europe from November onwards, right? And lived there. It'd be easier logistically as well. The biggest trade-off is, well, you're not really getting any results. So it's cool with these kids seeing that they are able to get results. And going back to the original question, like, does it prepare them? I think so. You have to remember that these are all juniors who basically haven't raced against international competition in 2 years. And you always have a sense of where you are, but it's only within that bubble. I think for all these riders, they went out there and realized that they're competitive internationally. And it takes a little while to sort of like establish that. And then also be comfortable lining up at a race saying, hey, I'm here to get a top five, I'm here to get a podium, I'm here to win. I don't think that happens the first time you show up, or at least that doesn't happen for most people, right? Now each one of those riders can show up in Fayetteville and be like, I've raced this person, I've raced that person, I beat that person, I'm here to get a podium, I'm here to win. I think you don't go to Europe and you don't get that experience. You don't know that going in.
Yeah. No, I think they definitely built a lot of confidence. But I mean, you look at this, I think that fundamentally, like, Ian and the Holmgren girls, I just think that they're just faster than we've had from cadets or first year juniors in the past. Like, you know, that little pocket, it's literally Rob's pocket of, you know, kids that have grown up. They have a really strong cohort there. And I just think they're better. Like, you look at them, how they did as at mountain bike nationals, they were all on the podium at mountain bike nationals as cadets, and they were riding as fast as the juniors. So yeah, the confidence in like racing well in the US, but then also just being faster than we've seen kids before, and maybe it's because they've started training at a younger age.
Well, and technically they're good. I feel like that's one of the biggest things. This is something we're going to talk about later, but let's jump to it now. Is like, what keeps North Americans from excelling in Europe? It's a lot of times it's technical skill, right? Like, sure, it would be nice to have more power. It's always nice to have more power, but I think this is something that I really realized last year when, like, there's been a few races where I've had really good races in basically tractor pull courses, where you're taking the technical elements out of it, right? Like last year when I got top 20 in Dendermonde, there was no technical ability there. It was just like a battle of who has a big old aerobic engine and where do you slot in, and like how you did was basically based off of that plus like who could run. And I think a number of times you actually see North Americans do reasonably well at those, even though that's the conditions that are the most unfamiliar to us. And to me, like, the only thing that says is when the course is more challenging, the course is technical, we're just not good enough yet. We need more time in that group training situation.
Do you think there is... I have this theory. I have a lot of theories. Here's one. I used to talk about this when I was... coaching basketball, and you'd have these kids, and it would be this irrational confidence, like this confidence in their skills that they did not deserve to have. They were not as good technically as their confidence showed. And I think one of the things that happens when these North American kids and even elites head over to Europe is like, it's not your house. It's not your home. You get into that starting grid. It's really unfamiliar. And again, this is just what I'm observing. You guys are the elite racers. I'm just seeing this from the sidelines, but it seems like it's almost like, okay, let me see what they do. And then I'll try to do the same thing, as opposed to sort of this irrational confidence where it's like, I can do this. I can do this better than you can do this, you know? And that's what I think we saw a little bit, especially from these Canadian younger riders. I mean, the Holmgrens, you look at Houlihan for both the Holmgrens and also for Ian, they were out front and they were like, this is easy. I can do this. This is not a problem. We can do this. You know, even at Herentals when they're in those drops, there wasn't a hesitation that you saw further back in the pack. And I think part of it is just having that familiarity with the races, a familiarity with who you're racing against, and that we now have more than just elite men's, elite women's races. You're able at a younger age to get that familiarity and say, okay, this is what it's like racing in Europe. And I put up this post just about the starting grid, because I always think it's funny that, you know, we're so strict in the U.S. and maybe we should stop this. We're so strict. The officials are so strict. They'll put the 8 lanes and then they'll, you know, every 6 feet will be like, you can't go over this line. This is the second row. This is the third row. This is the fourth row. And then you get to Europe and it's like, there's a first row. We know that. And then it just stops there. And then it's just game on. And that's the type of thing, if you're not used to it, if that's something that isn't familiar, we're not making those situations the same at home as we are internationally. So it's not as comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that starting grid thing always cracks me up a little bit, because it's to the point where almost every time I'm on the grid, at some point, if I'm there for like a 5 or 8 week, you know, eight race span, at some point a Belgian guy will make some joke about it. He's like, oh, it's like, oh yeah, in the US we have to line up right behind them. It's like almost a parody to the Belgian riders right now. But yeah, to get to your point, like you said, those juniors are going over there, and like you said, I think having those junior categories is such a big step, because all of a sudden the next trip they go over is a U23. Your memories, instead of getting your teeth kicked in, which would have been the case for a junior woman racing elite women a couple of years ago, now your memory's like, I was racing at the front, I won the whole shot, I was, you know, in second place for most of the race, whatever it was, I was riding great. Whereas a lot of times for us who started a little bit later, my first number of years racing in Belgium were, I was surviving. I was at the back of the pack. I was getting absolutely destroyed. And you kind of have to like build yourself out of that mentally and physically. It takes a while to go from finishing 40th and being okay with that to like expecting yourself to compete with the best Belgians. And that's like a switch that I've tried to switch in my brain. It's not easy. But instead of going, hey, I'm here just to race, it's like, no, I expect myself. I know that I can be somewhere further up in the field. And it sounds almost so simplistic that it should be like, well, of course, you just do it. But it is such a mental battle that I think for a lot of, especially elite men who go over, we expect not to be great. And lo and behold, that's what ends up happening. And, you know, credit where credit's due. I think Curtis, this past couple years, has actually started to break through and consistently, and that's the key thing there, consistently being inside that next group up, the group of, you know, consistently battling with people that you can unequivocally say are good bike racers. And we haven't seen that in a long time, probably since John Page or since Power spent extended time over there. We've seen blips from American men who like would shoot up and get a 10th place every now and then. But to be able to do it with that level of consistency, I think in some ways has like raised the game for everybody to look at the results and know that you're going to see Curtis finishing like 10th through 25th every single race, no matter what the conditions are. It, you know, he's younger than me and it like inspires me a little bit, being like, okay, that's the new level. Like that's where we need to hit.
Yeah. Do you think it's like the amount of time he's spent over there, and not just time spent racing World Cups, but time spent doing a variety of races over there? Because like having the junior categories to the younger athletes, like I even saw it, you came out of like, maybe it was a C2 race you did, and you were like a top 15 or like in the teens somewhere, as opposed to being like 30s, and you were just way more positive after that. So I think when people go over and spend the time in Europe, I think like we want to race the big races because that's where the best people are. I want to test myself against the best. But like, you know, we can do the same thing in mountain biking, being able to go and do like not necessarily B races, but yeah, like slightly smaller races with people who are at the same caliber, but just not as many of them. You can just get that whiff of the front and race a little bit better. Like in building a good European schedule, how important do you think that is?
It's important for sure. And I think maybe it's also important to go back and remember that Curtis, like I think we've all seen the photo of Matthew Vanderpool and Logan Owen and Curtis White standing on the podium in like Azencross or something like that. Bill, you might know this.
Sounds familiar, but yeah.
Like they've done the time. You know, they were what the Canadian juniors are doing now. Those they were on the podiums racing with the best, and like maybe this is, I guess there's two ways to look at it. Is one, because we're here not racing over there all the time, it took someone like Curtis a little bit longer to start hitting that level. Whereas maybe if you're always racing in Belgium, you roll into U23 and you're right there, and then you roll into elite and you're right there.
I think another part of this is the familiarity he has now. He's not an interloper in the circus, he's part of the circus. And where I see that is watching when you all do your little circular laps around the start grid in the beginning of the race, you know, that 5 minutes before the race where everybody's just doing slow laps around, you can see Curtis, you can see the North Americans, and they're talking to each other, and you can see Curtis, and he's talking to some guy from on Tournaments. He's talking to, you know, he is now in that group where they're not like, who's this guy? But it's like, oh, this is another professional we race with every week. And I think that's where you need to get to. So it's not, you're not an outsider, you're just part of it. And then you're part of it at every level. And of course it takes having to have those skills and having to have that ability. But I really think it is something that, you know, even you start a new job and you're not comfortable in that job until you're part of the team. You're on it, and that's it. You know, even though you're competing against each other, it's all a team. And if there's somebody out there that isn't trusted or isn't known, they're treated differently, and that person also feels differently. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well. You know, he's able to, I mean, and you are as well, Michael. You know, and Jen, you've seen it in mountain biking. You get to that point where it's like, all right, I can. You're in the flow and you're just a part of it, as opposed to being an outsider. And I think that's one of the biggest things. You know, everybody always talks about, we don't know where to shop, we don't know where to do this, but it's also, it's everything with that racing.
Yeah, we saw that with Magaly, and we've talked about this. Like, she and Dave finally don't hate it over there, and it's like, you realize, like, you know, they're not talking, they don't hate it, and she's racing faster. It was just like, that was literally the shift that happened. It was just from social media I saw, and it's like, it's night and day. It seems easy to do, but it does just take time in building that rapport.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's from talking, you know, like Bill was saying, when you're riding around with everybody else, it's instead of looking at the Belgian racers as, you know, someone else, I'm in their court, you're viewing it as one of me, you know, one of us, like, hey, I'm on the same playing field as them. And that's such a big difference. So I, like, is the answer for North Americans to just spend more time in Europe then and just get comfortable and spend a couple months every year there? Like, I think for a lot of us, myself included, that seems like such a hard thing to do because, you know, I'm comfortable at home. I have a house. I'm married. I like it here. But at the same time, when you look at other professional sports, that's like, I'm a big NHL fan. You would never dream of being in the NHL and still living in Russia if you were a Russian player. Like, you can't do that. If you want to play in the NHL, you move to North America. You travel to every city that you need to go to. You get traded from Vancouver to Montreal. You go and live in Montreal. Like, that's just part of the gig. So one thing I've wondered is, like, as cross racers, and as bike racers in general, we kind of have this luxury of, like, getting to choose where you live and getting to choose where your home is. And sometimes I wonder if that's the wrong mentality. It's like, and the Europeans have been saying this forever, I guess, but it's like, you want to be a cross racer? You need to spend half the year in Europe. I don't know if I like hearing that, but is that the case?
And isn't that part of the struggle that I know you and I, Michael, have had this discussion in the past? Is like, what do you do with cyclocross? What do you try to build it up in North America and make a kind of hybrid North American cyclocross sport and say, okay, we'll race internationally when we have to, but we're not, like, the goal isn't, somehow it's like right now, North America is almost like the Russian league in hockey. You know, you could go and play your whole career there and it'd be fine. But if you really want to make it, you go to the NHL, same type of thing. And I think that it's really every racer from North America, except for maybe Jonathan Page, who did live over there for years, has to make that decision. And I don't know if this hybrid doing both is necessarily successful. I mean, we've seen, you know, yeah, Magaly definitely, but they spent more time there and they've had more success. But I think you're right. If you want to do it, then you have to do it full on.
One of the other people, like, I have a lot of respect for Jonathan Page because he made the jump the other way. Another person I have a ton of respect for is Jamie Driscoll, because he was like, yeah, I don't feel like racing in Europe. I don't need that. I'm a US racer. And it was just such a, when everyone else was trying to do the half and half, and, you know, I'm doing that, like, I struggle with that too. Driscoll was like, nah, I want to go skiing. I'm not racing Worlds. I don't care. And it was like such a, I think a lot of people didn't understand that decision, but, like, all the credit to him for making it, because he knew what he was, knew what he wanted out of the sport, and was, like, totally happy with that. Okay, so let's transition from there to talking about the World Championships, because I think it's pretty interesting this year. We have no Matthew because of his back problems, no Wout because his team doesn't want him to go, or because he doesn't think it's worth racing Worlds if there's no Matthew. I'm not really sure exactly what the case is there. Does that take away from the World Championships? Do you think that riders like Wout, part of the reason they don't want to go because it's in the US, or has this just happened to be kind of a coincidence where Matthew ends up getting hurt, Wout ends up having big ambitions at, you know, Paris-Roubaix and Flanders and stuff like that? And what does that mean for whoever the winner is? Is there always going to be an asterisk by it, or is it, you know, the same as any other Worlds?
Well, I think for sure part of it is it being in the US. Like, that's a huge consideration, but I don't know if it was a 100% him decision, but probably like a combination team decision. Like, it was like a week trip for one race that probably doesn't necessarily add to the legend of Wout to win a race that he doesn't, there's not like a big battle, or the PR around it for him winning wouldn't be as good as going and winning Omloop or something, you know, for the team, I don't think.
Right, when we look at his legacy, are we really going to go, well, Wout only won 3 world championships, not 4? I don't know if we can really put him up there amongst the greats.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think that it's even, you know, I think that a lot of times the counting of championships is something that's great for fans of the sport, but there are definitely athletes who are concerned about their legacy, but many athletes, especially when it gets to that many, don't really care. It's just like, you know, you hear athletes when they lose a match or lose a game or, you know, cause something, it's kind of like, to be at that level, it's sort of like gone and they move on, where as a fan you're like, oh, this is going to affect me for the next year, this is all I can think about, this huge loss, where they're already done. But I think for Wout, he has nothing. You're absolutely right, he has nothing to prove in the sport of cyclocross. It's there's zero he has to do, you know. It's like, oh, he could win more than Vanderpool. I don't think he cares. I think right now he's more concerned about beating Vanderpool, if Vanderpool even races again, on the road. And that's what he's already joking about. Even with not going to Worlds, he's coming into training camp and he's going to be the last guy on the team up the climbs, because he's already that far behind. So he's already like nervous about his fitness now. You throw in there, you know, and it's not just a week, it's getting to Worlds, it's being in the US, which is a mess right now. So it's that extra risk of getting sick. It's going to a state that is pretty lenient on what they're doing as far as, you know, monitoring if people are getting sick. It's having to deal with that. It's having to deal with then racing, possibly getting hurt, possibly something else happening, getting sick, and then your season's just done. And I think that the risk reward, it's not even close. So I don't think that he was really getting that much pressure. I think he has ambitions that are not cyclocross. And I think that's completely reasonable.
And I think I was thinking about this on my ride the other day. I think sometimes we sometimes forget, it's like, oh, Matthew and Wout are, you know, slighting cyclocross or whatever you want to say to go focus on the road. And part of me is like, well, actually, we were pretty fortunate. This has never happened before. Like, was Tom Boonen racing cyclocross? No, Tom Boonen wasn't racing cyclocross, right? Like, this is pretty, has been a pretty exceptional period. The fact that cyclocross had 2 of the legitimately best cyclists in the world competing in its ranks for as long as it did, I would say that's unheard of. You know, Sven is the greatest cross racer of all time. Was he the greatest cyclist of all time? Not even close. Stibar, great cross racer. Did he go and dominate on the road? No. Lars Boom, same thing. Like, it's pretty exceptional that we had Matthew and Wout here for as long as we did. And I think now that you've seen that, now that we've seen that, it almost makes all the other cross racers look second rate. But if there was never Matthew and Wout at all, we'd be talking about Tone and Ellie and how they were, you know, the greatest of our time or whatever, and how they could maybe go over to the road and maybe, just maybe, be successful.
Yeah, we got a third guy like that too in Pidcock. Yeah, I mean, there's another one.
So, like, on one hand, I think it's easy to look at this and be like, oh, it diminishes the level of cyclocross. But I would argue, no, it's actually raised what cyclocross is up, that you have these three, what do you want to call them? 3 of the top 5, top 10 road racers in the world.
They're generational riders. They're generational riders, right? And they're fundamentally, they're bike racers. Yes, they started racing cross, but they're just bike racers. And I think their goal as athletes is to be the best bike racers possible. You know, some people, that means you have to focus on one discipline in order to find that success. But for them, they can branch out and find it in any discipline, more or less. So I think for sure it'll make Worlds, you know, we're going to be watching a race where we don't necessarily get the best in the world who necessarily will be wearing the rainbow bands, but I don't know, maybe it'll lift whoever wins up. Maybe that's like, that's, you know, when we talk about the psyche of belonging there and being able to win those races, like, yeah, these, you know, like the Ellies and the Toons can win, and you know, the Quinton Hermans can win before kind of those big three come in, but maybe it is just getting that really big win that gives them the confidence that kind of can lift them up. So maybe having an underdog world champion you know, finishing the season going into next year will be a super awesome thing.
Yeah, and well, think about, we talked about British cycling last podcast for quite a bit, and, you know, if Pidcock wins Worlds, which he's the favorite going in, that's a prime example of what we were just saying. Early success, successes juniors, leading, you know, and then sticking with it, leading to a, he's already one of the, you know, let's say the third best cyclocross racer, with Vanderpool injured, probably the second best cyclocross racer in the world right now, leading to a situation where you have him, where you have, you know, you have Thomas Mayne, you have all these other British racers coming up and finishing inside the top 10, inside the top 15 at all these races, where when I started racing, it was just Ian Field. That was it. It was Ian Field. He was finishing around where I was, maybe a little bit better. And less than 10 years later, the landscape has totally changed for the elite men's side of cyclocross and British cycling. Now there's like three or four people who are capable of finishing in the top 15. Like, that's a pretty rapid switch and pretty cool to see.
Yeah, and I, you know, on the women's side as well, you got Zoe Backstead, you got, you know, and they're sort of taking the legacy of, I guess it was Helen Wyman, Nikki Brandmeier were top British women at the time. You have Harriet Harnan just like shows up and like, I mean, I think that's the coolest thing ever. This enduro racer who's like, oh yeah, cyclocross, no problem, I'll go win the national championship.
But she had success in cross before she kind of like,
yes,
like as a, because she was on the under 23 podium as like a first, like she was still a junior, I think. And she's one of, again, one of those, I would say, potential generational athletes. Like, she's had top 10s in the under 23 mountain bike World Cup. She like winning EWS and like exceptional cross racer. Just, you know, not like kind of the road focused so much. She's definitely an off-road focused rider. Yeah, and like, you know, lump in Evie into there as well. She's another British rider who didn't race this year, but won World Cups. It's been world champion. Like, Great Britain has, when you talk about like a pipeline, like they're just pumping out athletes now and they're seeing the success and then more and more following.
So I guess, say, what does this mean for the cyclocross journeyman, right? What does this mean for the Ellies of the world, for the Sonic Counts of the world, that they're kind of plugging away, doing their thing, being successful for parts of the year, but at the end of the day, they're going to be overshadowed by those generational talents who you know, come in, drop in, and absolutely dominate and kind of leave.
Yeah,
and
but I mean, some people are just better than you, and you just, you like, some people are just better, so you just need to, you know, some of us, like most people are just never going to be that good, so you can still create your own legacy and just get your best results.
Right, but as a
again,
fan,
to try and be them, it's like, well, yeah, maybe I'm going to be overshadowed, but
I guess as a fan, though, how do we stop looking at the part, any part of the season where those generational riders aren't there as something that's not significant, something with an asterisk? Like, how do we stop looking at September, October, when Ellie's cleaning up, as like, oh, well, that's just Ellie before Matthew shows up, or Ellie before Wout shows up, right? Because I think that's important. Like, as a spectator, I don't want to sit there looking at everything for 3 months of the year going like, yeah, that's cool, but it doesn't really matter.
Did you feel the same way on the women's side? Because this was Sonic Kant's argument years ago, that it was these part-time racers would show up, they'd be perfectly fresh, he'd been racing since September, and then at the end of the season at Worlds, you know, like Thalita de Jong or whoever else would show up and win Worlds, and she's like, well, you know, but I don't think we thought on that side, it was like, oh, the best in the world aren't here. I mean, again, it comes down to those generational riders. I mean, I just think that if Matthew Wout and Pidcock weren't there, and I think you can even put Pidcock to the side there, because I think for part of that, those other two guys have put in their time. You know, I mean, they always flash back to those photos of them when they're, you know, 12 years old battling each other. So it's like they put in their time. And I think it's just one of those things that they're going to show up. But to go back to Worlds, since that's before we move on to other stuff, Michael, I want to ask you this, because you actually are the one in this room who has this experience. Everybody is already pointing at Pidcock as the favorite to win in Fayetteville. You raced Fayetteville at the World Cup. It was pouring down rain. It was super heavy. It looked like, you know, I always look like Gage Hecht, who's a great rider, but who did well. Top 10 finish there because Gage could put his head down, manufacture all those watts that he's capable of, and do well in there because it's not a super technical course. My first question for you is this course similar to Dendermonde? Because that's the one that I kind of, in my head, I'm comparing it to, and the one that the smaller riders out there, your Easer Beats, your Pidcocks, have a really hard time doing well at. Is that a good comparison or not?
I don't necessarily think so, partly because Dendermonde is super hard and heavy, but it's flat. It is pancake flat. And Worlds in Fayetteville has one of the biggest climbs I've ever seen in a cyclocross race in it. So yes, it can be a heavy climb, and yes, you need a ton of power just to make it up that thing, but being able to go uphill is still something that matters. So I don't necessarily think that it writes Pidcock out, but I agree, anointing him with the favorite status as the future world champion today, I think is maybe missing the fact that this could easily be a toned course. He's proven to be pretty good in these type of conditions. This could be a Quentin Hermans course. Like, heck, he won the World Cup. It could be Ellie. I think that the riders that almost need technical courses to survive might have a hard time, like Swake.
All right, Jen, you were in the last episode, you talked a lot about Namur and you talked about Van Turnhout. So that's a climby course, right? Is he the guy who's left out here? Could this be? I mean, can we just put Michael Van Turnhout as a world favorite?
We should do it for him. Like, I just led to a list of riders. The guy has won World Cups this year, and I didn't even talk about him. I forgot about him. Like, is it time? Yeah, is it time that you can tell, and to use your language,
and he beat
a topper?
And he beat Pidcock at Namur, right? I mean, he was able to outclimb him.
Well, see, this is why, like, not having, like, the big, the, you know, we don't have, like, Wout and Vanderpool. Like, I don't think it, like... I think it, if you, when you just like get past that and you're like, hey, you know, they're not here, you look at what's could happen. You're like, I have no idea what's going to happen. One, like we saw the race in Fayetteville, but my understanding is they're going to be doing some remodeling. Like they had the race and they're like, hey, we're going to do some updates. So it could become much more technical. I know in the mountain bike US Cup they had their last spring, they had a sick off camber and everyone was mad because they're like, this is a cross feature. We shouldn't have this in a mountain bike course. And then it wasn't in the Cross World Cup. So I'm like waiting for them to put some sick off cambers in. And then again, like you said, like Pidcock is the only one who hasn't. Pidcock and Sweek are the only ones who haven't raced this course. Everyone else has raced it. So I think there's part of that, again, in the experience of going over to like the US, racing in the US. Like, has Pidcock ever traveled and raced in North America before?
That seems like a funny question, but I actually don't know the answer. Like, you just assume that this English-speaking guy has raced in the US, but I can't think of any races.
It's one thing, but it's not the only thing, but it's worth considering.
Like, does he know where to get the best barbecue in Arkansas? I don't think he does.
Does he know about Chipotle?
Oh, man. What about Walmart? Does he even know what a Walmart is?
He will soon.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's literally going to Walmart Capital.
So there's been a lot of people, just an aside, a lot of people were like, oh, it's so weird that Walmart is the sponsor for the World Championships. And I'm like, okay, I can kind of see that. But like, is it less weird that Yumbo sponsors a major cycling team? Is it less weird that Ineos, a chemical company, sponsors the cycling team? Like, it's like, no, I think this is just the first time in a long time that in North America, we've had a major corporate sponsor that isn't a bike brand. And we think it's weird, but it's actually very normal.
It's because we perceive ourselves, most cyclists, as being too high-end to associate with Walmart. But when you just take a step back and be like, they're pumping a ton of money in, that's a good thing. Moot point. They're not asking for anything. They just want to host the biggest bike race in the world.
Talk high-end. Walton's also on Rafa.
It is interesting to me that they didn't want it to be the Rafa World Championships, but I guess why not? Give Walmart, like help Walmart's name a little bit, because I think all of us only associate Walmart with like a few things, and it's like bad environmental policies and cheap goods. Maybe now it's with biking as well.
Not great on the labor front either.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, but yeah, we have there's an exciting race, and like on the women's side for Worlds as well. Like, I'm loving. Like, I'm a big Lucinda Brand fan.
I love that Voss won nationals though. Like, it just throws so many more question marks into
exactly.
the air.
Exactly. Like, she won the world because she won the World Cup there as well. Or was it not even a World Cup? But yeah, she won that race. And then she like has this pretty rough patch where it's like she just, in general, not racing super well, but then rolling around to the race that matters and still being able to like come in clutch and win that title.
So I would be interested, is Voss not racing as well as she has in the past, or is everyone else that much better? And my gut says everybody else is that much better. And if you were to go and look at power numbers and ability and all that, Voss is where she's always been her entire career. I don't know if that's actually true.
I think in women's racing, for women's racing, I think that when you see someone who had dominated no longer dominating, it's and you see who is coming to the fore, not necessarily winning everything, but it's the younger riders. Like, the whole women's cycling is still growing so much more rapidly than people maybe give it credit for. Like, the depth of field is growing. And then the top is also just continuing to get pushed up.
Well, you can just look at the road side. She's still a force on the road. She's still a favorite every road race she enters and is able to pay that off with wins. So you can't really, her ability and her strength really hasn't diminished that much. I think it's what y'all are saying. It's that these other riders have really excelled. And you look at, like, women's cyclocross, I mean, women's cycling in general is at such a disadvantage in the past decade, further back from there, that now we're just starting to see these athletes coming up who really have the ability to be trained as professionals, have the ability to make a living racing their bikes. You know, there's still a long way to go, but that's something that Marianna Voss was able to be in a generation that I don't think the field was as strong as it is now. And it's awesome. And especially that she won Dutch Nationals. I think it's just huge since they dominate the sport and she was still able to win that. I'm sure that Lucinda Brand is like, never again do I want to race at Rookfin. They can just take that off the schedule and never have it as a race again. But at the same time, we can look at Worlds. And if you want to go back to how Voss performed before, she came in fourth. Brand won that race. I think Betsema might have been second. Yeah, and Clara Hansinger third, and then Voss come in there fourth. I don't know what that means, you know, from whenever that was months ago to now, but at least that's what we saw before in Arkansas.
Well, I think the conditions are going to be different. Like, September is one of the wetter months in Arkansas. January is one of the drier months, but I've also been told by people who are there that they go, yeah, it's drier, but the moisture sits around because of all the freezing and thawing. So we just don't know what the conditions are going to be. Is it going to be frozen and fast? Is it still going to be muddy? I don't know.
I predict an ice storm, because they get ice storms down there.
Anyone have those? I don't think they're allowed anymore. Do you remember those degausts that had like the glass embedded in them? That's what we all need.
they would cut through all the netting that was keeping the sod in place. So if you got that, you know, you wouldn't get that caught in your drivetrain anymore.
I don't want it to be an ice storm, but I've heard they can get gnarly ice storms down there. So like, if there was just one thing, like if they're just talking about this venue being associated with apocalyptic weather, it would be an ice storm. But I hope for, like, kind of like you're saying, Michael, a freeze thaw. The surface is greasy, but it's a little bit faster than last time, and they add a little bit more nuanced technical to the course is my hope as a spectator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, like, people have said lots about the course one way or the other. I do think that regardless of whether you think it's technical enough or not, or whether you think it's a little bit ridiculous that they built a cyclocross course the way they did, which I do, the strongest rider is going to win. I don't have a question about that. Whoever wins on that course will be a deserving world champion, without a doubt in my mind.
I just wanted to televise better, because it didn't look good on TV last time, so it was kind of boring to watch.
Yeah, I think we'll get many more cameras in there this time, so definitely get better looks at it. So out of all of the head scratching features of that track, Michael, I have my top of the list. What's yours?
So the one that cracked me up the most that I thought was the funniest is there's a couple points in the chorus where there was a tree in the middle of the chorus. And I just felt like they watched Zolder and they were like, ooh, cyclocross. Sometimes there's trees in the chorus. And they're like, we better build ours like that. And it just like, it almost made me chuckle, right? Because so many elements of that course were like, oh, we saw some courses have these whoop things. We better put those in. Oh, some courses have these little like ditches that you ride up and over. We better put one of those in. Oh, we saw this race the other day that had cobbles. We better put some cobbles in. And it seemed like, it was like just a hilarious combination of like, I saw this once on TV, we need it in our course. But probably the most head-scratching feature is like just that big stone mound thing. I don't know what it does. That's in the middle of the course before the finish line, you like kind of go around it. It's like a
the Stonehenge one, not the mountain that Jen knows exactly what you do. You ride down it on your mountain bike and it's pretty cool looking, where the stairs are on the backside. Oh, you're talking about the little like spirally.
Yeah,
like they built a spiral of death, but just out of
I don't know why.
Just spend $1 million to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
So mine is that, you know, were you all there in 2019 for Fayette Cross?
Oh, were we ever?
Yes. Yeah, the world's greatest right. cyclocross course.
Yeah. So the pits is where all that stuff is now. It was just a flat field that they've built mountains in. My thing is that they built this stone and dirt mountain, and it's a cyclocross race, and you go up all of these stairs, and then you go to the top of this really nice big long hill that they created, and they said, let's just send everybody straight down the other side.
It's the least technical feature of the course.
Like, it's just like, it's nothing. I'm like, you spent all this money on this. Get to the top, come around, and then go back. Yes, have an off camber. It's crazy. There's no off camber on that course at all. They had the perfect opportunity to just send people back whence they came at the top of that hill and have just a sick off camber. Put a piece of tape at the top of it, put a piece of tape at the bottom of it, and say, go nuts, guys. Try to figure out how to get down.
Do you know what we've never seen that they could actually build here? Is an off-camber spire that goes under the stairs. Like an off-camber spiral of death that goes under itself with a flyover. That would be such a cool feature. Like, I'm not even kidding about how cool the feature that would be. Can you just imagine the visuals of like running up and then like descending down and under where you ran? On like this giant conical...
I support this.
Oh, it'd be so cool.
I support this.
The other mind-boggling thing about that is, like, who sods a cyclocross course? What? Just, like, throw some dirt in and, like, sprinkle some grass seed. It'll grow. It's fine.
That was the UCI. Told them that the dirt conditions, I guess there's some shale in there, was not conducive for cyclocross. And they were like, no problem. Got out the checkbook and spent a lot of money to put all.
They went
that
to
sound.
The garden center. They went yes. to the garden center.
Yes,
they loaded it all up.
The TM Walmart garden center. But like, this is going to backfire when Tom Pidcock's on his way to victory and gets a bunch of like that plastic netting caught in his cassette. Just wait.
Yeah,
yeah.
Environmental disaster.
Okay, just, Walmart's not worried about an environmental disaster.
Just to come full circle with what you all were talking about with Canadian Nationals to start with, and you were talking about Magali and doing well in Europe. I think she is the good case study for why you don't give her the points, because I think she has the opportunity to do well at Worlds, you know, definitely, as we like to say in the US, medal capable. And if she were to get on a podium and then there was, oh, but she got this free 100 points that put her in the front row that she didn't deserve. It's a controversy in the making that I think that she still can do just as well without having any of this stuff that Europe can sort of put their hat on that, you know, oh, a North American really wasn't deserving of that spot.
Yep. And honestly, on that Fayetteville course, I think it's hard enough that it will not matter. Like I,
and it's wide open too. Yeah. It's not like you're bottlenecking.
If Worlds were at Holst, people would be upset, or I would be upset about starting any position further back than I thought I should.
We talked about it last week on Cyclocross Radio, where you know Zach has this whole thing about features being too close to the front, and I was like, hey, it's okay at Holst. They took the planks out of the first 30 seconds of the course, but then not 2 seconds later sent you into the smallest right-hand turn off camber ever on a course ever. And I was like, almost leave the planks in there just to slow people down because you have this stupid off camber right at the start of the race.
I know we weren't going to talk about Holst at all, but it was one of the most frustrating experiences I've had as a bike racer. And I know mountain biking's like this sometimes, Jen, but like standing and pushing each other to funnel into this tiny little thing. And then even when you get going, it's like, it's hard to race. You're like, well, I'm in 50th now, and 40th is 30 seconds up the road, and first is already a minute and a half up the road. Like,
yeah, I watched that race and I was like, the course is too fast to have that kind of change in speed. But pro tip for you, next time you're in one of those, like when everyone's standing there holding their bikes beside each other, pick your bike up.
Curtis
over
did that.
Your head. No, I'm dead serious. Because think about it. Like, what's limiting you getting around in this, like, mob is your bike. Put it above your head, and you can just, like, I'm just demonstrating here, just noodle your way through there. There's a kid in the under-23 men's race Canadian at Mountain Bike Worlds who did just that. It was in Val d'Isle, kind of had a similar chicane. Must have passed, like, 20 or 30 people just, like, running through the field with his bike above his head.
I just love the visuals, too.
Good advertising for the sponsor.
That's why you do it. Sponsor placement. Oh, he's riding a giant. I didn't see that before. Boom. Front and center. No, Curtis actually did that.
Yeah, see, the guy knows what's up. Guy's smart racer. Consummate pro. Big pro man over there.
Yeah.
The world's course looks like it's a good course because it's going to provide super fair opportunities. And again, like having a less favorable start position doesn't matter until it does. Like, the strong people will get to the front, but I think people who are farther back on this, like, if you have the power, you're going to just make your way through. Will the men's and women's races both be like 50 minute races, or is it 50-60?
50-60. Then the women's have been, okay, yeah. They've, credit where credit's due, the women's races have been 50 minutes this year, at least.
No, it's been good racing.
And they've been exciting through every single one of those 50 minutes in a lot of cases, where I think, as we've said many times before, there's been lots of races where the men's could have been one less lap, and let's face it, nobody would have noticed. Like you said, I think the funniest part about the world's course is I do think it's a fine course. I have no issues with the course itself. I think there's a certain amount of hilarity when you think that, like, somehow North America convinced ourselves that you had to, like, build these things like that, whereas half of the really good races in Europe, it's like they didn't build anything. They just put the stakes in the same spot every single year, right? And the race just happens. The course design was good, but there was nothing constructed. The only exception I can think of that is, like, Hoggerheide has those stairs in the middle of the roundabout, right? And I guess those were built for cyclocross, but I don't know. I'm sure if you told Erwin Vervaeken how much money, from who he runs Galazzo, who runs a lot of the races, how much money they spent on this, he would laugh and say, I have no idea why you did that.
Yeah, but they built that staircase, and now there are apartments that have built up at the top of it, so it led to something at Hoggerheide. And now those people have a front row seat to the race. It's great.
How much do you think that boosts their property value, like getting to watch Hoggerheide every year, especially this year when no one else can? Can you sell your deck as a VIP zone?
Did you see all the people come out of the woods for Herentals?
Yeah, I saw those. I'm just like, I thought there was no spectators.
Well, they all
allowed.
Got kicked out. The cops came. They kicked them all out. But it was hilarious. It was just all these families came streaming out, cheered for Wout when he came down the hill, and then vanished again back into the woods.
Were they even there? Was it real?
I love it. It's like so different than North America. We can't convince people to come watch the races. In Belgium, you can't keep them away.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I think at Worlds, I mean, I guess it totally depends. But I hope that hopefully there's some good energy around the racer people. I know from the racers there will be, but I hope that there's, I mean, you kind of hope, don't hope, because it's just like COVID situation, but.
Yeah, it'll be, I still remember Louisville as like such an awesome fan experience, because I was there both as a racer, and then I was U23, so I got to watch the race after that, and it still sticks in my mind as one of the greatest, most supportive, most fun crowds I've ever been a part of. And definitely COVID throws a wrench into that, because like you said, I'm hoping we get that, but at the same time it's like, well, let's hope we get that, but they're 6 feet apart and fully vaccinated at the same time. I don't know if that can happen.
And this is a whole nother hour discussion, but the other difference is that we didn't know if we were ever going to see international riders on U.S. soil again at that world. So it was like, we are going to just live it up to the nines at this race. And it was amazing. And it was also a time when I think Cross was really at its top in the U.S. at least. And now we get to see pro racers every year. We get to see them at three World Cups, and it's like that novelty is gone, and I think the excitement sort of needs to have a reboot. So maybe this will do it. Maybe we'll see.
Yeah, I think, yeah, we should probably wrap things up here pretty quickly, but there could for sure be a whole nother discussion about World Cups on U.S. soil, USCX, what the path forward for U.S. crosses, because
North American cross,
including Canada.
Come on,
Canada.
Michael. We are part of this.
I always say it. Come on.
Sorry. North American. As I used to tell Dylan, who I ran the team with, I'm an American too. Because he would always refer to himself as, you know, to just U.S. riders as Americans. I'm like, no, I'm an American too. Don't get ahead of yourself here. But yeah, it's there's a whole other discussion for like what's the sport off to next? And I think sometimes as racers, as you know, sometimes I can be pessimistic about it. But I think there's some real reasons for optimism moving forward about what the sport's up to. And we're not going to talk about them today. We'll just say there's optimism and leave it at that.
Let's earmark it there. And how about we catch up, Michael, before Worlds, so we can touch base about how your prep's been, and we can do some predictions going into Worlds. How's that sound?
Perfect. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Absolutely. It's great to have you. Fan of the podcast. So I was happy to be on here. I'm going to leave you with this one last thought as a button for your should cyclocross be in the Olympics, because Jen, one, you brought up my favorite points about like basketball not being a summer sport, which was great. Here's one thing. One, the only thing keeping cyclocross out of the Summer Olympics is there isn't enough room for cycling events. So what should the cycling event be that should be in the Winter Olympics? It should be downhill, because downhill is a race the clock, and you look at the Winter Olympics and every race in the Winter Olympics is against the clock, except for maybe like speed skating, where every event in the Summer Olympics is against other people. Cyclocross is against other people. It should be a summer sport. That's it. That's all I got. Thanks for having me on. This was awesome. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill. So percolate on that, everybody.